as friends of Andrew and James, to support them. Welcome here. If you don't know me, my name's Kate and I'm the minister at the church. And we will be enjoying time celebrating, blessing marriages, and also doing various normal things that we do on a Sunday. I want to read a little bit out of the Bible. I went to the Olympic Park yesterday in London, Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park, I think it's called now. And it's amazing because I went there during the Olympics, and to go there now, it's amazing the amount of work they've put in and how different it is. And it made me think the amount of time it takes, because let's face it, what are we in? 2015, that's like 3 years since the Olympics. There's still a lot of parts of the park that haven't been redone, but they've done a lot. It made me think, amazing the amount of work they've done. But then I looked in the Bible, and about the creation of the universe, it says this: "When I consider your heavens," God's heavens, "the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what are mere mortals that you are mindful of them, human beings that you care for them?" When we consider the universe, the work of God's fingertips, some translations say, not meaning that God got in there with actual fingertips, but that every detail he imagined and created. And we think about the amount of time it takes for us to change a little bit of land into something else. We think about how amazing God is, that the moon and the stars were seen and created by his hand, so to speak. Today, of course, we rejoice in the marriage of Andrea and James. It has finally happened. Yeah, I know, a few little cheers. We want to thank God today for this expression of love which has come together in their marriage. And we also want to stand with them as their church family here to support them and to pledge our support to them as well. And we come together to ask God's blessing upon their marriage too. First of all, though, I'd like to invite Grace up. At the wedding, Grace read a poem, and she's going to read it to us today as well.
The owl and the pussycats went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money wrapped up in a £5 note. The owl looked up to the stars above and sang to a small guitar. "Oh, lovely pussy, oh, pussy, my love, what a beautiful pussy you are. You are, you are, what a beautiful pussy you are." Pussy said to the owl, "You elegant fowl, how charmingly sweet you sing. Oh, let us be married, too long we have tarried, but what shall we do for a ring?" They sailed away for a year and a day to the land where the bong trees grow, and there in the woods a piggywig stood with a ring at the end of his nose. His nose, his nose, a ring at the end of his nose. "Dear pig, are you willing to sell for 1 shilling your ring?" said the piggy. "I will." So they took it away and they were married the next day by the turkey who lives on the hill. They dined on mince and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon. And hand in hand on the edge of the sand, they danced in the light of the moon. The moon, the moon. They danced in the light of the moon.
Wonderful. I was a bit disappointed that Andrea wasn't in, you know, the full dress. But T-shirts will do for the blessing. Got the photos. Yeah. Who needs a dress? Got the photos. So, we'd like to bless you today. And we'd also like to support you. I just want to ask a couple of questions, you know, just to make sure all went well last week. So, James.
Yes.
Have you promised before God to be faithful to your wife, Andrea, to love her as long as you both will live? Wonderful. That's the right one. Excellent. And Andrea, have you promised before God to be faithful to your husband, James, and to love him as long as you both live? Wonderful. Another round of applause for that. What we want to do today is to ask God to bless your marriage and your family, and to be in all that happens from this moment on. He has been all that's been happening up to this point, but we want to ask his blessing. So let's just pray together as we ask God's blessing upon their marriage. I also want to ask everyone here a question, if that's all right. The appropriate answer would be, "We will." be great if you could say that. The question is this: Andrew and James have affirmed their understanding and their resolve in marriage, the one that was begun last week. And I'm asking you, will you, family and friends, church family and friends as well, support and uphold them in this marriage? Will you do that now and in the years to come? That's good, isn't it? Excellent. So now we'd like to bless you. May the Lord bless you. May he make his face shine upon you. May he bring you his peace, and may he surround you with his love from this day and forevermore. Amen. Oh, you are making yourselves comfortable. Swapping places. I didn't really mean it. Just like... For those of you who have been coming for a few weeks, you'll know that in this church we've been looking at the book of 1 Thessalonians, which, for those of you who haven't been coming for the last few weeks, I'll just explain. It was a letter written by Paul to a church in Thessalonica, explaining all sorts of things and challenging them about all sorts of things, commending them on their lives and how they'd stuck with God even though they were being persecuted and harassed by people around them, but also challenging them about how they live before God. And last week we looked at the end times and how their worries about the end times were concerning them, and Paul told them not to worry. And this week we continue with that. So I'd like to invite Miranda to come and read our next passage from the book of 1 Thessalonians.
I don't think, friends, that I need to deal with the question of when all this is going to happen. You know as well as I that the day of the Master's coming can't be posted on our calendars. He won't call ahead and make an appointment any more than a burglar would. About this time, everybody's walking around complacently, congratulating each other. We've sure got it made. Now we can take it easy. Suddenly, everything will fall apart. It's going to come as suddenly and as inescapably as birth pangs to a pregnant woman. But friends, you're not in the dark, so how could you be taken off guard by any of this? You're sons of light, daughters of day. We live under wide open skies and know where we stand. So let's not sleepwalk through life like those others. Let's keep our eyes open and be smart. People sleep at night and get drunk at night, but not us. Since we're creatures of day, let's act like it. Walk out into the daylight, sober, dressed up in faith, love, and the hope of salvation. God didn't set us up for an angry rejection, but for salvation by our Master Jesus Christ. He died for us, a death that triggered life. Whether we're awake with the living or asleep with the dead, we're alive with him. So speak encouraging words to one another. Build up hope so that you'll all be together in this. No one left out. No one left behind. I know you're already doing this. Just keep on doing it.
Thank you, Miranda. I just want to take you back a few years, if I could, just for a moment. I want to take you back to the 31st of December 1999 at 11:59. As you may know, this would be the turn from the 1990s into the year 2000. And I'm sitting in a room with my friends, waiting for that magic moment. Because we have been told over the last few months that we should beware. Because at the strike of 12, on the 31st of December 1999, everything will go into disastrous meltdown. Because there's this bug, the dreaded Y2K bug, the millennium bug, which is going to, apparently, affect all computers on the turn of the millennium. Everything will reset itself to zero and all will fall apart. America set up two think tanks to work around this whole subject. And they concluded that on the strike of 12, power would go off. Phones would stop working. Toilets would stop flushing. Natural gas would stop flowing. Bank accounts would disappear. Traffic lights would stop working, nuclear sirens would go off, and planes, trains, and automobiles would go completely out of control. Basically, all computerised systems would fall apart. On the 1st of January 2000, computer programs would cease to operate. There would be nothing. The end of the world was nigh. Clearly, it didn't happen. And on the strike of 12, we all sat there. Way, it's New Year. That was about it. But then I went into work on the 2nd of January, wondering what would have happened to my sturdy computer. Will it have exploded, turning my office into a blackened hole? Will it not work? Will, when I turn it on, it spit things at me? I sat down, I turned onto the computer, and to my delight, the only thing that had happened was that it had gone back to 1984. So the worst it could do was play a medley of the Nolan Sisters to me, or something such, which, let's face it, is probably quite bad. Sort of like the end of the world. But of course, the world didn't come to a sticky end in the year 2000. We're all still here. But since then, apparently it's been predicted to come to an end twice more, did you not know? In the year 2011 and in the year 2012. Neither of these took place, of course, although I did put off writing a sermon in 2012 because it was supposed to happen on a Saturday. That didn't help me out much. I was then stuck on a Sunday morning. But don't worry. Even if those predictions were untrue, we have another prediction. This time, it's not a year, it is a time span. The world is predicted to end now between 2018 and 2028, with the most likely year being 2021. Okay? 10-year margin of error. That could be right or not. I think it's fair to say that as human beings, based on all the predictions over the years, that however much we try and however much margin of error we have, one thing that we're not very good at is predicting the end of the world. We see it as something that will happen, and we see it as something that will be in the future, and we see it as an event that we cannot avoid, but we're really quite hopeless at knowing when it will take place. And we don't really know a lot about how it will happen either. I remember when I was little, well, little, teenager, and I was in youth group, and it was a church youth group, and we went one evening and they had this man doing a talk on the end times. We were also very excited because we all had these images of what might happen, and he sat us all down and he said, at the end of the world there will be a great judgment. And we're like, okay, right, it'll be like this, it'll be as if there are big screens erected in front of everyone, and on those screens God will play the most awful things you've ever done or thought or said in front of everyone, and no one will escape. We were all like, oh my word, everything will be played in front of everyone. Terrified all of us, and for about 2 days we pretended to behave a little bit better. But, you know, then went back to normal because you sort of forget about the big screens and the judgment. And I don't really know what images you have. You might have had the same sort of image in your mind. There's going to be a huge judgment. There'll be big screens or whatever, and everyone will know all the things we've done. I don't know what you think, whether you have the same images as I did then. And I don't know when we think the end of the world will come, how we see it or when it will be. But I imagine we see it as an event that will take place in the future, whether it have big screens, judgments, internet access, whatever we imagine. I think we probably all believe it's something we're heading towards, something that's not here yet, but will be coming at some point. And you know, in this way, the Bible agrees. In this passage that we just read, Paul says, while people are saying peace and safety, everything's okay, destruction will come as suddenly as labour pains on a pregnant woman. Oh, and we know that just comes on, doesn't it? No escape. The Bible agrees that we cannot know when the end will come, even though we try and predict it. But interestingly, the Bible doesn't agree with our thinking that all of this will take place somewhere in the future. The end and everything after that is somewhere down the line, so we don't have to worry about it. The Bible doesn't agree with that. In fact, it has a completely different view about the future. Because in many ways, it sees the future as something that is sort of already here. In this letter, for instance, written to the people in Thessalonica many years ago, Paul doesn't talk about the future and the present in terms of one being here now and one coming a long way down the line. Instead, he talks about them in terms of darkness and light, or day and night. He talks about the world in which the Thessalonians lived as one that was like being in darkness, one that was eternally night. It's a bit like, you know, C.S. Lewis has Eternal Winter in Narnia. It's a bit like that, the world as being eternally dark. And in the time that Paul wrote this letter, that was actually quite apt, because in first century Roman world, especially for people who went to church, Jewish people who'd been converted to Christianity, it was a very dark sort of existence. Things were very difficult. It was like living in darkness. There was persecution. They were pushed out to the edges of society. There was hardship. There was suffering. Times were difficult. On the other hand, in some sectors of society, people were making the most of the darkness before the light came. They were just enjoying anything that was before them. They were setting up ways of life that thrived in the darkness. They were settling down into the conditions of the Roman Empire, quite enjoying what was going on. For some, living in that kind of world that seemed very dark was what they wanted, whereas for others, the darkness was what they wanted to escape. But either way, it could be said that it was as if nighttime was upon the world, and people had no idea when the day would arrive, when the daylight would come. And so interestingly, instead of writing to these people who were struggling and encouraging them by saying, "Don't worry, the dawn is about to break. Don't worry, day is coming. Don't worry, light is about to arrive," Paul says, "Don't worry, the future's already here. It may seem to be nighttime, and people may be living as if it's nighttime, but don't worry, because the day has already come. The light has already broken in. The dawn has already arrived." Now, by this, Paul wasn't meaning that some weird scientific phenomenon had taken place where daylight and darkness had become confused and the world had gone mad. Instead, he's using an analogy, as I'm sure we're very aware. He's talking to people who believed in Jesus. And so therefore, in effect, he's saying, look, it may seem like life is hard and God is a long way away, but you know, actually, when Jesus died on a cross and rose again, that very act that brought you together as a church, it wasn't simply a historic event that took place at a particular moment in history. It wasn't an event that people could choose to believe in or not. It was actually an event that changed the world, because in effect, it was an event that brought the future into the present. When Jesus died on a cross, the future of God came into the present. So now, however dark it seems, however dark life is, however meaningless things might seem to be, the light is here. Or if you like, God's love is here. God's grace is here. So is Craig, who wants to come in. God's acceptance is here. God's forgiveness is here. God's mercy is here in the present. In other words, the darkness has been broken. And now the light, the future of God, will forever shine in, wherever you might be, whatever you might be doing. So Paul says to these people, don't fall asleep. Don't fall asleep again as if it's night. Live as if it's daytime. Stay awake. Catch glimpses of light and live as children of the light. Now, this might seem a little bit of a confusing concept. But, you know, if we think about our world today, if we think about the things that are going on and the things that are happening, there is a lot of support for a picture of a world that lives as if it's nighttime. This imagery of darkness. You know, we live in a world where many awful, awful things happen. where things can be very dark. We live in a world where children are sold into slavery. We live in a world where people are dying of thirst. We live in a world where simple illnesses are killing thousands because all the resources are the other side of the world. We live in a world where people blow themselves up daily, killing hundreds of people. We live in a world where regimes slaughter whole towns and cities because of what they believe. We live in a world where little children are shot at school and where students murder teachers. We live in a world where people go and sunbathe on a beach and they're gunned down as they lie in the sun. We sort of accept it, but if we think about the horror, we could say we're living in a very dark world. We could put our world under the category of darkness. And I guess also there are those who are making the most of the darkness as well. Those who indulge in pleasures, those who set out ways of life that thrive in darkness, those who settle down as if this is all there is. I guess we all do that. As if it's nighttime and there is no daylight. We live and we wait for a day in the future when the light will come. Some people look forward to that day, whereas others prefer not to think about it. But we all live as if this is now and the future is to come. Whereas Paul says, this is not how God works. He's not sitting back, waiting to swoop in and sort everything out one day. He's not watching from afar, seeing how much of a mess we can get ourselves into. He's here now. He's here in the darkness. With his light, with his love and his mercy and his grace. Of course, one day he will come and the future will be fully present. But for now, these tiny bits of light continue to shine in the darkness. Do you know, when I first moved to London, I lived in a flat on the Kidbrook Estate. I don't know whether you know anything about the Kidbrook Estate, but it was where, as my sister likes to remind me, it was where the shoe bomber came from, the one on the plane. Anyway, I lived on the Kidbrook Estate, and I was in this room in someone's house, and when all the lights were off, it was like pitch black. You couldn't see anything. I was down in one of the sort of little basement rooms. Actually, I don't know where they really wanted me to live with them. Anyway, they put me in this room to sleep, very, very dark, and I had this little clock radio, which used to put a bit of light into the room. And one night, I woke up and I couldn't, and I sat bolt upright in bed and I'm going, I can't see. I've gone blind. And I'm like, I'm doing this. And I couldn't see a thing. I thought, I've gone blind. Something has happened in the night to make me blind. And I was like, oh Lord, what am I going to do? And then I realised that there'd been a power cut and my clock radio light had gone off. And I wasn't blind at all. It was just, there was no light coming into the room. So I lay down, heart pounding, palpitations, went to sleep, woke up, no problems. The light was coming in. I wasn't blind. And you know, made me think, the tiniest bit of light in a very dark place can make a huge amount of difference. It's the difference between thinking you're blind and knowing that actually you can see. And you know, when Jesus died and rose again all those years ago, it was a sacrifice that not only brought light to people in the Bible that we read about, but also a sacrifice that punched holes in the darkness for all eternity, so that the light of God could shine through even in the grimmest of circumstances. It was an act that enabled the future to be glimpsed in the present, so that the present could forever be changed by the future. As Paul says here, for God did not appoint us to suffer, but to receive salvation through the Lord Jesus Christ. God does not wait to punish us with big screens and all that. He breaks in now with his love and his goodness, so that we can be rescued. So now the light is here. Now the way of God reaches down to us through the simplest things. I don't know, the hug of a friend, the kindness of a stranger, the forgiveness of someone that we don't even think that we deserve. those little things that bring kindness and goodness. Now that the light is here, we are called, just like the people in the Bible, to stay awake. Stay awake. Don't fall asleep again. Don't fall asleep again. Don't believe that it's night and the light is a long way off. Don't go thinking that there's no hope and the darkness is all encompassing. Don't accept this as final. Instead, stay awake. For some of us, that might mean that we look a bit deeper into actually what Jesus' death means for us. Really? Does that really, is that what it means? Or for others, it might mean that we simply cling on to the promises of God when things are looking really grim. But whatever it is, we are urged, just as these people years and years ago were urged, to savour the light of God in the middle of darkness. So that even in the darkest times, we can know what it is to live as children of light. Let's just pause for a moment before we pray together. So as we hear of that grace, as we sing of that grace, may we recognise it. As we walk around, as we go about our daily business, may we see the grace of God, the light that has punched holes in the darkness, and may we have the strength to live as children of light. May God bless us and keep us and walk with us. Please be seated.